This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One new book that might be of interest is The End of Policing by Alex Vitale. Recent years have seen an explosion of protest against police brutality and repression. The conversation about how to respond and improve policing has focused on accountability, diversity, training, and community relations. Unfortunately, these reforms will not produce results. The core of the problem must be addressed, and that is the nature of modern policing itself. Broken windows practices, the militarization of law enforcement, and the dramatic expansion of the role of police have created a mandate for officers that must be rolled back. This book shows how the expansion of police authority is inconsistent with community empowerment, social justice, and even public safety. Alex Vitale demonstrates how law enforcement has come to exacerbate the very problems it is supposed to solve. In contrast, there are places where the robust implementation of policing alternatives, such as legalization, restorative justice, and harm reduction, has led to reduction in crime, spending, and injustice. The best solution to bad policing may be an end to policing as we know it. The End of Policing by Alex Vitale, out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Last week, I spoke to Aziz Rana about the lack of serious anti-imperialist politics across much of the American left. Today, my guest is Timothy Mitchell for the first of a two-part interview on the pivotal role played by coal and then oil in the history of capitalism, imperialism, and democracy. In this first episode, we'll talk about how the rise of coal made both industrial capitalism and newly powerful worker resistance possible, and how the shift to oil then facilitated the persistence of imperialism in a decolonizing world while thwarting worker organizing. On the next show, we'll discuss a lot more, including how oil companies in Western states made autocratic governments and conservative Islamists key partners in creating the very global order that we now find in such profound crisis. The discussion is informed by Mitchell's book, Carbon Democracy, Political Power in the Age of Oil, published in 2011 by Verso. I'm trying something new here with longer interviews by breaking it up into two parts. Let me know what you think. Before we get this started, we're in our spring fundraising drive at patreon.com/thedig. We need your support to keep this going. And I'm asking you to, right now if you can, hit pause and join the more than 800 listeners who are already supporting us. Our goal is to reach 1,000 total supporters by the end of June. For $10 a month, I'll send you Jacobin's ABCs of Socialism. For $20 or more, I have a bunch of other books that you can choose from. At the moment, including Aziz Rana's Two Faces of American Freedom, Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind, and Melissa Gira Grant's Playing the Whore. I'm really grateful that you all make this show possible, and I get an email every time one of you donates, which reminds me in a really nice way that even though I'm sitting in the studio by myself, that ultimately you are out there listening and appreciating what we're doing. So please help us reach our goal at patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. Here's part one of my interview with Timothy Mitchell, a political theorist and historian of the Middle East at Columbia University, who, amongst many other things, is the author of Carbon Democracy and Rule of Experts, Egypt, Technopolitics, Modernity. To Timothy Mitchell, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Your book's central argument is that fossil fuels helped create both the possibility of modern democracy and its limits. So before I get into a lot of specific historical questions, explain this overarching point that you make.
I started writing the book, at least thinking about it, after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when there was a lot of discussion of the relationship between oil and democracy, particularly in the Arab world. Somehow the undemocratic nature of that region was associated with having lots of oil. And I found that argument very simplistic, and part of the problem was it didn't actually think about oil itself, and it also didn't think about the longer history of the relationship between forms of energy and forms of democracy. So although the book has a lot to say about the Middle East, it actually addresses this question of oil and democracy by looking back further into the past, over the previous 150 years or so, to understand a wider relationship between the ways we have produced energy and the kinds of opportunities that have resulted from that for creating more democratic societies or for setting limits to them. One thing this enabled me to do was to tie the history of oil production in the Middle East actually directly to the history of democracy in Europe and the countries of the North. So I can take you into the specifics of the argument, but it was that relationship. It was to stop talking about oil as simply a problem of oil-producing countries and think of it in relation to the wider world in which energy is used and how that shapes democracy.
I want to talk about first the oil, the conventional oil scholarship, and then the conventional democracy scholarship. The oil scholarship, you write, misses the mark because it focuses not so much on the oil, but rather on the money that oil makes. And an upshot of that is that it tends to highlight the so-called oil curse to explain oil-producing countries' deviation from the unmarked democratic norm, as if they're these sort of curious basket cases. But you make it clear that the democratic West are oil states, too. Tell me about the conventional approach on oil and why it's important to follow the oil instead of the money.
Right. And the conventional approach to thinking about the problem of oil and democracy in producer states like those of the Middle East doesn't actually have anything to say about the oil. It just sees what it calls excess revenue. It's never clear what defines some kinds of revenue as excess rather than others. And that revenue either distorts the economies of producer countries in some of the economic accounts or in the political science accounts, it distorts the politics by giving regimes spare cash to spend on suppressing dissent or something of that sort. It's a very simple account, and it's one that actually doesn't think about oil or energy itself. It's about a problem of somehow excess money, and it's not very convincing in my view. The way to connect that to broader histories of democracy is, first of all, to go back actually before oil became the most important single source of energy, to an age that was dominated by coal. Because surprisingly, if you think of a country like Britain in the 19th, early 20th century, Britain was, if you like, the Saudi Arabia of its time. It had this extraordinary energy resource, coal rather than oil. And yet the possession of that energy resource, rather than somehow being a curse or distorting some supposedly normal process of politics, actually allowed working populations in Britain, and similar things happened elsewhere in Europe, to mount successful campaigns for more democratic forms of politics, quite systematically from the 1880s through to the 1930s, and again even after the Second World War. And it seemed to me that you couldn't understand the oil curse unless you related it to this rather different history in relation to coal, partly because what then happens after that relatively successful mass democratization in parts of Europe, Europe finds itself partly de-democratized by the ability to turn to an alternative energy source, in the case of oil. So as more and more oil became available after the Second World War as a supplement and an alternative to coal, it became easier to defeat the kinds of political movements that had been organized around the supply of energy. So there seemed to be something in the energy sources themselves, in the ways they were produced, distributed, controlled, that allowed one set of energy sources at one moment to seem to enable forms of mass democratization, and in another moment, both for producer countries and for consumer countries, to be associated more with limits or reductions in the extent of democratic politics.
It's almost as though the actual history has more to do with global political economy and imperialism than it does to do with the implicit argument that brown countries can't have expensive things.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the problems with the conventional approach to democracy, whether one's thinking about its absence in some kinds of countries or its miraculous appearance in others, is the lack of this kind of technical and material history of how it came about. If part of the reason that the account of the oil curse jumps very quickly to says nothing about the oil and jumps very quickly to people having too much money and the distorting effects of money, it's precisely because they want to somehow, at some level, locate the explanation for political defects in the way people think. Ultimately, it becomes in the end a kind of absence of the proper culture of politics, because that's what the oil money is said to distort. And of course, the counterpart of that in conventional accounts of the rise of democratic forms of politics elsewhere is that in many liberal accounts, it was a process of people gradually becoming more aware, becoming open to the culture of democratic life, and that's expressed in terms of concepts like civil society, tolerance, and so on, that I found equally unsatisfactory, and again, not particularly relevant for thinking about the specific ways in which people were able to fight for more democratic forms of life using the opportunities offered by dependence on coal.
An irony in this conventional infantilizing and racist account of the oil curse is that it recapitulates the very sort of imperialist and developmentalist orders that your book's about.
Yeah, because, you know, one part of those kinds of understandings of the world was always a kind of cultural superiority of the West and a historical view of the world where the West had achieved certain things, including forms of mass democracy, which were then to be exported to other parts of the world. And of course, this was the fiction used in part to justify that invasion of Iraq in 2003, that this was the opportunity finally for the United States and its allies to bring democracy and enlightenment to a world that had been cursed by its absence. So that runs right through standard accounts, both generally through history and even in public discourse around things like the war against Iraq.
One more thing before we get into the history on the you touched on it a little just now, this long running scholarship on democracy and democratization that you're intervening in, the conventional account prioritizes norms and institutions on the one hand, and on the other, really the idea of democracy as if it's something that just has to be inculcated. But by contrast, you argue for a notion of what democracy can mean and what struggles over democratization are, which you write are struggles to define not just what subjects are subject to popular debate and contestation.
The standard accounts will frame things very much in terms of a certain kind of enlightenment, a certain kind of institutional frame that allows enlightened discourse to prevail, and things of that sort. I tend not to take that approach. I tend to think that people pretty much everywhere are not in need of enlightenment by others, they're in need of the mechanisms, the kind of apparatus that can allow their voice, which already exists, to be heard and force people to listen to it. And it's that apparatus, that mechanism, that how you build such a world so that those voices do have to be heard, and not democracy in the abstract, but specific demands over specific ways of living either a more prosperous or a less precarious form of life, can get enforced. And that it's a kind of enforcement issue. It's a matter of having some way of having one's voice count, not having sort of learning how to have a voice that matters.
I'm currently reviewing Just Such a Conventional Account for N+1 by a political scientist named Yasha Munk. I'm not sure if you've encountered him.
I don't know the work, no.
But it's remarkable how much these sorts of accounts of democratization are premised on really bad history, typically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's almost always a set of assumptions about how democracy came about elsewhere that is written out three quarters of the story. One of the specific things is often confusing the rise of forms of liberal constitutional government, which happened earlier, happened in the course of the, in many cases, in the course of the 19th century, starting early in the 19th century, often with a series of demands for a more rule-bound kind of government, and for a kind of government in which a broader part of the elite, propertied elite, had a voice. And there was a form of constitutional liberal change in many parts of Europe through the course of the 19th century. I distinguish that from democracy, which comes later in almost every case in examples in the West, because, of course, that liberal constitutional government was compatible with slavery, with massive colonialism, with not giving the vote to women, and with not giving it to a very large part of even the male population. So it's important, and often that is not obvious when people are thinking of the history of democracy in the West as models for elsewhere. And I'm much more interested in a series of developments that in different ways happened in various coal-based places between about the 1880s and the mid-20th century, not the earlier history of constitutional forms.
The conventional accounts typically frame democracy's history as this redemptive arc whereby there was this really good idea that was unfortunately limited to, or that some people were unfortunately excluded from, and then this idea ultimately over time becomes more true to itself through mm-hmm. through the expansion of the franchise and whatnot.
Right. And to me, what's more interested in how groups who were excluded successfully find the tools to fight against that, but equally the ways in which more recently in the last 5 or 6 decades, many of those gains are being lost again in a whole variety of ways, which I think the history of energy politics can also help us understand.
Diving into the meat of your book, I want to talk about sabotage, which is a central concept that you use. You look at how it was the very process for extracting coal and transporting coal that allowed workers to leverage the power of sabotage to advance democratic struggles. And then the geography and methods of oil extraction and distribution, by contrast, allowed oil companies and Western governments to successfully attack democratic struggles via sabotage. And there's a lot here, so I want to start with coal, which on the one hand allows for this absolutely massive and just enormous increase in energy and thus in production and transportation that also allowed for this, you know, novel forms of intensive exploitation, but that also critically put these workers in these positions in mines, on railways, on docks that gave them the power to shut the whole system down by disabling critical nodes. Lay out the political economic geography of coal and what you mean by sabotage.
Right. We're talking, as I say, about the later 19th century. Of course, coal had started to be used widely before that. Its origins go back much earlier, and it's being used quite widely earlier in the 19th century with the rise of steam power. But it's being used alongside many other sources of energy, water power, wood, animal power, and so on. By the late 19th century, it is becoming the dominant source of energy. Key changes when it starts to be used not only to drive steam power, but also to generate electricity, and then the electricity can drive other forms of uses of energy. And so in that period in the late 19th century, what one's got is this extraordinary quantity of energy, because the actual use of energy has increased in amount, but also its concentration in narrower and narrower channels. Before, when you had multiple sources of energy, some of them like water or wood, renewable, others not, there were many, many sources of energy, and it was often very close to where it was being used. And the idea of somehow cutting off a supply of energy to an entire country was just unthinkable politically. With coal, these enormous and ever larger quantities of energy start to move along very narrow routes from the pit, the coal pit, to the railway on which it's moved, to the docks, from the docks to the power stations and other centers where it's mostly consumed. And what happened was that groups of workers at these key points, the coalhead, the railway yard, and the docks, realized that a relatively small groups of workers who were linked not so much by being part of a political movement or by sharing a political ideology, but rather linked by the fact that they were at different points in the movement of a single source of energy, could, by withdrawing their labor or other forms of what came to be called sabotage, shut down the energy supply effectively to an entire country. And this was the first time that it was possible to shut down production in a country as a whole. And it became to be known as the power of the general strike. And general strike didn't mean everybody in the country going on strike. It tended historically to mean this triple alliance of coal workers, dock workers, and railway workers. They came to call it sabotage. The word was new around the beginning of the 20th century. It hadn't actually yet been used in military circumstances. It didn't have the connotations it had today of sort of blowing things up. It meant actually sort of slowing things down, interrupting things, finding some small key point in a process where a slight delay or interruption or blockage would somehow disrupt an entire system. And that was what these new networks of energy made possible, this relatively simple act of disruption that threatened to shut down a country's entire productive life. Now, general strikes themselves were relatively rare, although they did happen from the 1880s onwards in Germany, in France, in Britain, in other countries that had begun to depend on enormous amounts of coal. But just as important was the threat of this disruption, and it was in response to that threat that one finds a whole series of radical changes, this change from a kind of liberal constitutional form of government in many cases to much more developed forms of mass democracy, in which the vote is extended right across the working population. It's extended to women a little later, partly to, as it happens, to sort of try and dilute this power of working men, or so people thought. With that power, either the threat or the actual use, there's a fundamental change in the conditions of collective life. It's the origins of what we think of as the basic forms of social democracy, where for the first time people win the guarantee of things like a retirement pension in old age, provision of basic health care, right to education for their children, accident insurance in case they are injured at work, and all the other things that become the normal protections against the extreme precarity of of working life. And that's a fundamental change. And it's a power of sabotage that is called that at first. The word then takes on these military connotations and it's not used, but in some ways we can sort of reappropriate it to talk about that ability to decisively interrupt some process so as to make effective political demands that, as I say, these were not new. People have always looked for ways to produce a less precarious and a form of life, but for the first time on a mass scale since the rise of the industrial age, they started to be radically effective.
You write that in the late 19th century that many on the left saw the general strike as, quote, an anarchist tactic that should not take the place of organized political action. And even Rosa Luxemburg, for a time, argued that Belgium's 1902 general strike only worked because of the country's geographic concentration of industry. But Luxemburg obviously soon changed her mind. To what degree did the political economy of coal and the power of sabotage that accorded to workers force Marxists to change or update their analysis?
I think you see that. You see that in Luxembourg and others, and events in Russia, the revolution of 1906, are quite remarkable. We can talk about that in a moment, but of course also Belgium, what happens in Germany, what happens elsewhere. I think in some ways what's interesting, and I'm not a scholar of debates in Marxist theory in that period, though I know enough to see the influence, and in the book quote Luxembourg and others to see how they're taking notice and trying to make sense of this sudden new power that seems to be appearing everywhere in Central Europe, in Russia, and elsewhere. And that doesn't seem to have needed to wait for some spread of mass consciousness. As I say, perhaps that was always there. What's spread is the ability to build these effective apparatuses of making demands out of these connections among the forms of energy supply. I think in some ways what's more interesting is the reaction on the other side, on the right, because I think one can see in the interwar period a very clear understanding that whatever else may be happening, and even as late as, say, people writing in 1945, capitalism has ended. Writers like The Economist, Joseph Schumpeter, somebody actually on the left rather than right, Karl Polanyi, many others looking at the world as it has been transformed in the interwar period, say, with the rise of these governments that have had to become attentive to the mass demands that are being voiced by these key alliances of workers, whatever the new world is that's being built, it's not capitalism. As it happens after the Second World War, things take a different turn, which we can talk about. But one of the things that happens is simply many of those changes remain, but people think for ideological reasons it's easier to just keep calling it capitalism than to realize how fundamentally things have changed between, say, the 1880s and the interwar period.
Moving on to what happens next, the shift to oil was explicitly part of the strategy to repress labor because it shifted the power of sabotage from workers to corporations and nation states who exploited key differences in the way that oil was produced and transported. And I want to quote from you here. You write, "Whereas the movement of coal tended to follow dendritic networks with branches at each end but a single main channel, creating potential choke points at several junctures, oil flowed along networks that often had the properties of a grid, like an electricity network, where there is more than one possible path, and the flow of energy can switch to avoid blockages or overcome breakdowns." Explain what was new about the way that oil production and distribution were organized and how those changes were exploited.
First, mentioned some things that were the same. As an oil industry begins to develop, and I concentrate mostly on the case of the Middle East, beginning in the 20s and 30s, and then in the a period after the Second World War, you have workers trying to do very similar things to what was done by coal workers in the West, to start making demands, often first quite locally about housing conditions, employment conditions, and then to try and use their critical place in an energy process to make much more far-reaching demands. So Iraqi workers in the 1930s, Iranian workers in the same period, Saudi and other Gulf workers in the 1940s and the 1950s, wave after wave of political strikes, making demands partly over the conditions of labor and the precariousness of their lives, but also demanding, in the case of Saudi workers, political constitutions, for example, and similar demands in Iran and Iraq, also over the ownership of the oil. But those kinds of strikes and political demands turn out to be easier to defeat. Not that there aren't some quite violent political struggles in places, but it doesn't prove possible for oil workers, even as they connect their demands one group to another, to have this same ability to shut down energy systems. And there are a number of reasons for that, but the place I start looking is actually in the material properties of the two forms of energy. With oil, it's a liquid and it comes out of the ground initially under its own force, so you don't have to send a workforce underground. The workforce is smaller, it stays on the surface, it's therefore under supervision, more easily controlled by management. And then as a liquid, oil can be pumped in pipelines rather than moved by rail, and that pipelines, although they could be sabotaged, were on the whole simpler, less complex technical devices than railways, and they were much more difficult to interrupt. And then once it gets to the terminal on the coast, it's moved by tanker. Tankers, unlike rail transport for coal, again, are harder to disrupt the movement of. Their labor forces are usually not unionized. They move under international flags with non-unionized workforces at sea. And they're moving on water rather than on fixed route by rail, so it's harder to interrupt the way in which energy moves from one point to another. If there's a strike at a particular port, the tanker can move and unload at a different port, and so on. So in all those ways, the fluidity of oil compared to coal, the way it comes out of the ground and the way it's transported, just made it far more difficult to construct those kinds of apparatuses of sabotage that have been possible with coal. The other thing, of course, is that oil came second. It was initially produced as a supplement, an alternative for oil. It was often burned in ships as a form of fuel, just directly converting steam-driven coal-fired steam turbines to oil-fired and so on. So it came second. It was an alternative, and it was available as an alternative. So the very fact that one had a second source of energy was already diversifying the possibilities for those who depended on energy to avoid the kinds of interruptions that one was subject to. So one sees this, for example, when Winston Churchill famously, on the eve of World War I and just after it, is arguing for the British Navy to complete a conversion from coal to oil, and even though coal is in some ways a much denser source of energy that can drive ships more quickly. One of his arguments is that if we get oil from places like Iran, where he wanted the British government to take over new oil fields, we won't be subject to the political demands of the coal miners of South Wales. So there was this very clear sense that in diversifying your source of energy, you were freeing yourself from the kinds of constraints that you've been subject to when you were dependent on just one source. And in addition to that, because you were going from South Wales all the way to Iran, you were, of course, going to get your energy a long way from where it was going to be used. With coal, with industrialization, with coal, those energy networks were relatively short in extent. Most coal was used used relatively close to where it was produced. And so, of course, industrialization tended to have occurred in regions that were close to coal fields, mostly. And whereas oil, because oil came second, it actually became available elsewhere where oil happened to be, a long way from the sites of industrialization. So the kinds of networks that might connect to the producers of oil, say in Iraq or Iran, to the users of oil, typically in Europe, were very, very long, very difficult to coordinate along politically because of those new distances. And that exactly was what Churchill was saying. We will not be subject to the political demands of the coal miners of South Wales. We'll be getting our oil from Iran, where, for a variety of reasons, political demands will be easier to police.
And you write that oil's kind of intrinsic properties and the way that that allowed for its distribution was leveraged quite early by employers against workers. You say that in Pennsylvania in the 1860s, the first pipelines were introduced to undermine teamsters who transported oil by the barrel to rail depots in horse-drawn wagons.
Yeah, you see that very early on with oil. Once it becomes particularly where it's being produced, as it were, relatively closer to sites of industrial production, as in the U.S. or to some extent in the Russian Empire early on. And therefore, the threat of unionization and disruption is closer. Very quickly, the advantages of its liquid properties are realized, that you don't have to transport it in wagons, which have these teamsters, the original teamsters who drive the wagons. You can build pipelines originally out of wood, but then pretty soon out of steel that are much easier to control, don't involve so much opportunity for workers to disrupt. You find the same thing, for example, with oil in the Russian Empire. Baku on the Caspian Sea in the Caucasus is one of the world's largest sites of oil production in the early 20th century, and a lot of that oil is used, is shipped across up the Caspian and up the river systems of Russia to be used in Russian industry, but it's also moved by pipeline. And again, there are the advantages of pipelines, in this case, to get it out from the Caspian across to the Black Sea, are very rapidly realized.
This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Police, A Field Guide, by David Correa and Tyler Wall. It doesn't take firsthand experience to learn the meaning of pain compliance or rough ride. Police, A Field Guide is an illustrated handbook to the methods, mythologies, and history that animate today's police. It is a survival manual for encounters with cops and police logic, whether it arrives in the shape of officer friendly, tasers, curfews, non-compliance, or reformist discourses about so-called bad apples. In a series of short chapters, each focusing on a single term, such as the beat, order, badge, throwdown weapon, and much more, authors David Correa and Tyler Wall present a guide that reinvents and demystifies the language of policing in order to better prepare activists and anyone with an open mind on one of the key issues of our time, police brutality. In doing so, they begin to chart a future free of this violence and of police. Police, A Field Guide, by David Correa and Tyler Wall, out now from Verso Books. I want to introduce a question that I think we'll probably return to in different forms a few times, which is the question of how technology relates to particular political economic forms. And you write that the very properties of oil as compared to coal, oil's, quote, fluidity and relative lightness, played an important role, but that it wasn't just entirely technologically determined either. It was also political and contingent. And an example of this contingency that you write about are the oil workers in Baku who launched the Russian Revolution of 1905. Mm-hmm. But you write that while the oil workers' labor mobilization would ultimately prove somewhat exceptional, the way that it would was crushed would become pretty normal, that the Russian imperial government used ethnic divisions to break the struggle by way of sectarian violence. Explain the role played by oil and its related technologies, and what other causal factors are residual and contingent. How that issue of to what degree technology is determinative, and to what degree things are left open to contestation and, I don't know, human choice.
I don't want to suggest any of this is a kind of technological determinism. What I'm trying to do is to bring this history of technical processes into the history of democracy, not to sort of add it as one more factor that we ought to think about, or even as the decisive factor, but rather say that the object we are thinking about, the kind of process we are thinking about, the successful construction of an effective political agency that can make demands, is something that has this technical aspect to it. If a group of workers are able to successfully make political demands, it is the assembling of a demand-making machine out of parts that are partly technical that I want to understand, not to say that, oh, they did this because oil made them do it or coal allowed them to do it or so on. So it's sort of actually getting apart and looking closely about what we mean by the possibility of political action and how political action is assembled out of diverse things that are partly technical, partly political, partly human, partly based in energy forms and so on, that is what I'm trying to do in this work. So in the case of Baku is in the Russian Empire, in the Caucasus, is an interesting one because it's a sort of hybrid of two different kinds. To say it's one of the early sites of very major oil production, one of the biggest sites in the world at the beginning of the 20th century. But in a way, the role that the oil of Baku, of course today it would be Azerbaijan, is playing in Russia is in some ways more similar to that of the role that coal is playing in Europe at the time. It is the dominant source of energy. Russian industry depends far more on oil than on coal. Russian locomotives on the rail system are fired by oil rather than coal. Russian engineers have developed ways of atomizing oil so it can be sprayed and used as in a combustion system to drive steam engines, and they get steam turbines. So in all kinds of ways, oil in Russia is being used like coal and is directly tied into an industrial system, as opposed to the sort of great distances that open up elsewhere between energy production and industry, with Middle East oil being used in Europe, for example, later on. So the fact that it's a sort of in between of the two kinds of cases allows one to get away from any simple energy determinism. You know, tell me what kind of energy you have and I'll tell you what kinds of politics you have. And indeed to look at all these different ways. How is the energy produced and moved? To what extent is it the sole source of energy rather than a supplementary one? How far is it from the sites where it's employed and so on? But of course, this still is the periphery of the Russian Empire in the Caucasus. And one of the things you see happening there, which again is a little different from the coal fields of Northern Europe, is that against the threat of the Russian Revolution in 1905-1906, one of the things that government is able to do is try and transform political contestation into forms of ethnic rivalry, and to exploit the fact that the oil industry has been built on a very ethnically divided labor force.
Which is a theme that will come up time and again in your book and throughout this interview.
And so, it's interesting to think. I mean, in fact, the main workforce in Russia was Iranian. And what happens after 1906 is that Iranian oil workers, the industry is pretty much shut down and is dead for largely a decade or more. And those Iranian oil workers all go home to Iran. And in 1907, they become an element in the 1907 Iranian Revolution, the so-called Constitutional Revolution of 1907 in Iran. So there are connections immediately there with Middle East history that are of interest. But that's the particular interest in Baku for the book.
And concretely, the way that the Russian government crushes the uprising in Baku is by exploiting Azeri enmity against ethnic Armenians. Is that right?
It works. There's an ethnic enmity that it exacerbates between Russians and Georgians against Armenians. There's also ethnic religious one against Muslim populations, the Persians in particular, and so on. And it happens, in multiple ways. But part of the point is that when these oil industries coming to being in the more diverse, more, to use a modern word, multicultural peripheries of empires, one sees this tendency to sort of build workforces around ethnic divisions. They're easier to police. There's lots has been written about the sort of ethnic division of labor and the way in which it works historically in the organizing and dividing of labor forces, and you see that very clearly in the case of Baku.
I want to turn to the Middle East now, which is, of course, a huge part of this history that you write. What do conventional accounts of the region's oil history, as portrayed, for example, in the book The Prize, what do they portray and where do they go wrong? You write that it wasn't so much about the control of oil, as people, I think, left, right, and center tend to think, but rather a matter of controlling and limiting its supply. What did Western governments and corporations see in Middle Eastern oil, and what was their goal?
Right. So you mentioned Daniel Yergin's book, The Prize, which is still the most widely read magisterial history of the oil industry across the 20th century. And it's a very well-written book that is wonderful to read. But it reproduces a certain way of understanding the history of oil in the Middle East that one sees in almost every account one comes across. It's a story of white European and American pioneers trudging across barren deserts and mountains looking for this oil to discover, and then having discovered it, building heroically the industry and the corporations that took the oil out of the ground and made it available to civilization. And of course, with that goes a view much more widely found in accounts of oil right through to the Iraq War and beyond, which is that the problem they face is that the oil is scarce, and one's got to grab it as soon as one can find it, and that having grabbed it, one's got to secure it against others who might want to take it away from you. And so with that comes a whole language of security, of national security. And I think almost every part of that story is wrong. And I look in some detail at how oil was actually first being produced in Iran, Iraq, in Egypt, in the Gulf. The first thing is that throughout almost all the 20th century, the problem with oil in the Middle East wasn't how to find it and how to secure it. It was that there was too much of it. In some places in Iran, Iraq, and even in Egypt, it was known just to pour out of the ground. It wasn't necessarily that hard to find, at least in initial amounts. But even as
because these companies were trying to protect oligopoly cartels arrangements, basically.
Right. Here's the thing about oil. And again, it's an important difference from coal. Coal was found very widely across Europe, North America, and other places, but was too expensive to transport very far. So it would tend to be used fairly close to where it was needed. There were exceptions. You would need coaling stations around the world for steamships, but most coal was used relatively close to where it was found. Oil was found in relatively few places around the world, the Middle East being a major location. But once you'd found it, you could sell it. It was light enough and cheap enough to transport because of its liquid form that you could use it almost anywhere. So there were two consequences to that. One was that a handful of companies could imagine the possibility of actually taking control of every significant site of oil production everywhere in the world. That's unthinkable with coal because of the diversity of places it was found and the difficulty in moving it. But with oil, it so happened that very early on, in the early 20th century, six or eight companies begin to establish a system where they take control of every significant site of oil production in the world. And it's an oligopoly situation that arises very quickly. And it doesn't arise very quickly because somehow with oil, you automatically get rich. It wasn't the case. It arose because you could make extraordinary profits if you could organize it as an oligopoly, as a system controlled either at the production site or the distribution site or whatever by very few companies. And of course, famously, it was the Rockefellers who first organized this initially in North America and Europe, and then attempted to spread their monopoly around the world. And then they were challenged by a handful of new European companies, what became later on known as BP and Shell and Total and so on, and the Rockefellers. Just to give them their modern names, of course, the Rockefeller companies essentially became Exxon and Mobil, or today Exxon Mobil.
Securing those profits required restricting supply to drive up price.
Right. So you've got this energy that on the one hand is available only at very certain places around the world. But on the other hand, is enormously cheap to produce. So there are two alternatives. Either it's so cheap that you can't make much money out of it, and it'll just be sold by local producers who will distribute it and, you know, add on a little bit of profit. Or because its unusual geographic distribution allows the possibility of monopoly, you could monopolize it and actually sell it many, many times its cost of production. So, and of course, that's what begins to happen. Once you can do that, then the threat you face is not that you might run out of oil, that you might not be able to find more oil, is that other people, rivals, might start up production next door or in the next country. And so understanding the history of oil production, its development over the first 50, 60, 70 years of the 20th century in the Middle East, it's about not what heroic acts can we do to discover and find and expand oil, but how can we limit its production? How can we find a few key sites, monopolize those, restrict production from them so that there's always somewhat of a shortage and we can charge higher and higher prices, and prevent its development at other sites. And that's essentially what happens across the whole Arab world in the course. It's a system put in place early in the 20th century, and it lasts through to the 1960s and 70s.
So the problem is for European and American oil companies, or I guess maybe more European initially, is that this oil exists on other people's land, which brings us to imperialism. And control of oil is often seen, even by critics, as having been a strategic state interest for Western powers. But you argue that this interest shouldn't be taken as a given fact, that it's something that oil companies actively worked to create and sell to governments. Explain this and how the early history of oil in the Middle East, how that took place within this imperial context.
Much of this oil is in different parts of the Arab world, and the beginning of the 20th century, much of the Arab world is still part of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Turkish Empire. The other site is right next door in Iran. There's different strategies in relation to each of those two countries, and the oil companies at work are relatively few, mostly European. The American oil companies get an interest too. The key agreement is made with the Ottoman government right on the eve of the First World War, between a number of oil companies and the government in Istanbul, essentially to give these companies a monopoly of the whole empire. The empire then collapses, and somehow, by a sort of legal sleight of hand, that agreement is considered to survive the end of the empire in the post-war period and to govern oil production in the successor states. And those successor states are what become Iraq, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, and eventually Saudi Arabia and the smaller Gulf states. So that agreement is an agreement among these monopolizing oil companies that they will not develop oil anywhere across the Middle East, except in agreement with one another, according to quotas that will limit the supply and maximize the price they can charge. So the one exception, the area that isn't under this agreement, is Iran, but Iran is under the control of the company that becomes BP, and BP is actually a major partner in the agreement covering the Arab countries. So you've got put in place this extraordinary system of monopoly right across the region. And so what you see happening in the interwar years is a modest amount of development of oil in one or two sites, Iran, for example, and a little bit in Iraq. Elsewhere, Saudi Arabia, for example, even though oil is discovered in the early 1930s, effectively no oil is produced of any significance until after the Second World War. Even in Iraq, where oil is produced, the British companies, BP, that's controlling production there, what becomes BP, they're deliberately drilling shallow wells so as not to find much oil. And if they do find oil, they're often spiking the well and not letting on that they've found it, because they want the oil just to come out at a rate that is low enough to maintain very high prices. So the story we have of heroic discovery and a source so strategic that you have to do everything you can to guarantee its supply is actually happening very, very differently. If you like to use my earlier term, it's the oil companies who are now doing the sabotage. They are strategically cutting off or interrupting the supply of oil, not in support of worker demands or anything democratic, but rather in support of maintaining prices for oil that are many, many times the cost of production.
What are the imperial powers doing to support the oil companies, and why are they doing it? Is it in the interest of empire or of the corporations, or both and neither?
It's a bit of everything, and it depends a little bit from country to country. So, in the case of Iran, for example, the country is not formally colonized by any of the imperial powers. There are troops that occupy it during the war, and Britain and Russia, and the government is under enormous pressure from those two powers and related to its oil resources.
And Britain is sending in soldiers from India.
Yes. Yeah, so Iran, of course, is at that point, this is prior to the partition of India, Iran shares a border with India. And so when Britain needs military forces anywhere in this region, including to invade Iraq during the First World War, the bulk of the forces come from India, not from Europe. That's been the case even back when Britain invaded Egypt in 1882 and established its colony there. So India is important to all this. But elsewhere in Iraq, for example, there's a little bit more of a tension between the British imperial control and the interests of the oil companies. The British, after the First World War, as they occupy these areas of the old Ottoman Empire and divide it up into these separate states and establish governments under their control, they have an interest in the funding and the stability of those governments, because at that point, imperial powers like Britain are finding empire very expensive and they want to cut costs. And one way to cut costs is to make sure that the local governments have the resources to do the policing and the state building that they want them to do. Whereas the interest of the oil companies is to, in many cases, minimize oil production just enough to sort of keep their rights in place and to pay the local government as little as possible for the right to produce that oil. So sometimes you find the British government actually split between the interests of the oil company and the interests of the client state that they're trying to help organize and build. And that conflict unfolds differently in each case and with slightly different dynamics over each decade. So, of course, for the oil companies, what's absolutely critical is that the imperial powers are there in some form or another, either directly occupying the country or controlling and influencing its government. But that doesn't mean that the imperial powers are simply doing the bidding of the oil companies once they're there. They've got other interests of their own in terms of cost cutting, stability, and so on.
Hi, this is Aziz Rana, and you're listening to The Dig. As you know, The Dig is an essential podcast doing critical work and shaping the meaning of what the left can be today. It's my favorite podcast, and you should support it by donating at patreon.com.
Hello, this is Daniel Denver, host of the show that you are listening to. The Dig has launched its spring fundraising drive, and we're aiming to hit at least 1,000 supporters at patreon.com/thedig. By the end of June. We don't paywall our shows, i.e. we give them to you for free. And so we depend on your support to keep this thing running smoothly. That said, we do have cool stuff to send those of you who do donate. Contribute $10 or more a month, and I will mail you a copy of Jacobin's ABCs of Socialism. $20 or more, and I'll send you a bunch of books by Dig guests and other great left-wing authors put out by Verso and other publishers. And that's not it. I just started a weekly newsletter for everyone donating at least $5, which, amongst other things, offers ideas for future reading from me and from my guests. Please take a quick moment and contribute what you can at patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. We can't do this without you, so please and thank you. And back to the show. Arab nationalism and other forms of resistance obviously quickly poses a challenge to the control of Western imperial powers and oil companies. And I want to ask you about what those early movements looked like and the methods that the imperial powers and oil companies used to respond. One really fascinating thing that I had no clue about that you write on is that the very notion of self-determination, which is often misremembered as this liberationist idea put forth by Woodrow Wilson, was actually had its origins in a project to maintain imperial dominance.
Right. I somehow work in a little history of Woodrow Wilson, his 14 points and so on, partly because I am looking in some of the chapters of the book at how this modern state order in the Arab world came into being after the First World War. And in most accounts, it's associated with the peace conference at the end of the First World War and Woodrow Wilson's support for a principle of self-determination and the very partial and failed way in that promise, that promise was fulfilled in the case of the Arab world, because although independent or quasi-independent states were established or recognized across the region, they remained under significant colonial control in the period after the war, largely by Britain and France. And one of the things I want to show is that Woodrow Wilson didn't really significantly oppose that. So, for example, when an Egyptian delegation came to the Paris Peace Conference and said, "No, we're not going to have continued British occupation of Egypt. We're going to have this independence where that's been promised," Woodrow Wilson refused to support them. And I think it's important to understand where the idea came from. And it's actually got two kinds of genealogies. One is actually...
And it's a really... I just want to highlight how crazy the latter genealogy you're going to go over is. It totally floored me.
The left in Europe has become highly critical of imperialism, of the idea that these, and particularly what it has been doing in Africa, the Congo crisis, the genocide that has occurred in Congo and that's come to the attention of the European left in the decade before the First World War, the South African wars before that, and so on. There's a mounting left critique of imperialism. And the principle of self-determination from a left perspective was articulated in that context. It was also taken up by Lenin. And following the Russian Revolution in 1917, and at the as Lenin and the Bolsheviks withdraw Russia from the war, they start articulating a principle of self-determination.
And then there's the South African story.
Then there's a whole South African part of it, because there's been the South African series of wars in South Africa between the British and the Afrikaner settlers, and a whole sort of emergence of a new form of South African politics, in which the notion that self-determination is a kind of a way of solving the problems of rights of different racial groups is articulated there. So there's also this alternative sort of colonial understanding of self-determination as a way of saying that each group can have some say in its future. You know, it will not form a sort of unified system of political rights or form of democratic politics, but rather there will be some way in which each group is allowed to tell us who they want to be ruled by. And in the context of African politics, that's what it tended to mean, consulting people about the form of their domination. And that's really the tradition much more on which I think Woodrow Wilson is drawing. It's usually mentioned self-determination in connection with him and with the 14 points he declares as the points on which the U.S. enters the First World War and which it is seeking a settlement for. People overlook the fact that nowhere in the 14 points is a principle of self-determination mentioned. And on the contrary, what it says is that in the peace settlement, these imperial powers are going to have to balance their interests with the interests of the subject population. So no principle of independence, no principle that people themselves determine their own future. Rather, you have to fit your own demands into the demands of imperial powers. But what imperial powers have to do going forward is listen to what you say about who you would like to rule you or represent you. So in the system of government that was developed for places like the former Ottoman Empire, that took the form of Woodrow Wilson insisting that as Britain and France occupied the countries of the Arab world, the actual form of the occupation and which colonial power was going to be occupying should be decided on the basis of consulting the people about their views. You can have a say in your colonial occupation. That was Woodrow Wilson's notion when he finally started using the term of self-determination, at least as it applied in the post-war settlement in the Middle East. It wasn't a principle of political freedom the way it ought to be.
You write that self-determination was not a problem for imperialism. It was a solution. And
exactly.
You point to the case of Iraq, where the British had wanted initially to keep Basra as a port for oil and have a puppet government in Baghdad to control the rest. And ultimately, they imposed an emir, which is like this cartoonish anachronism, in the person of Faisal.
A king, actually. I mean, the term emir, which is often translated as prince. I mean, some of the more powerful families of the Gulf had become called emirs, and it had become this term for a ruling family. But actually, across the region, the British decided they wanted something much more modern than that. So, in fact, most of the rulers they put in place or secured in place in Iraq, in Jordan, and even in Egypt, they announced they were kings. They created these hereditary monarchies, which was an institution largely unknown in the region. And certainly the idea, the title of king, was something entirely new. But then, of course, Britain was ruled as a hereditary monarchy. So to Britain, this seemed like a nice sort of modern thing to do.
But we now attribute these sorts of political forms in the Middle East as coming out of their own, irreparably anti-modern
tribal backgrounds
when they're imposed by the West.
And this was imposed in the case of Iraq against uprisings and political movements that were trying very hard not to have this imposition of a British imperial system under a puppet government. But of course, the British had a new weapon, which they put to work whenever people objected, which was they had a thing called an air force, and they just took off and they bombed villages or towns that were objecting to the imposition of this new order that was put in place.
And I would be remiss not to highlight Churchill's fierce advocacy of bombing the hell out of Iraqi civilians, because the hagiography surrounding that man is just utterly relentless.
No, well, I mentioned the book The Prize, which is the standard heroic history of oil. And in fact, the title is taken from Churchill, who claims that that oil of the Middle East is the great prize that he has helped Britain seize in helping the British government to fund and then take half ownership of the company that becomes BP. So I play with that a little bit because it's a rather different story when you tell it differently.
That was part one of my interview with Timothy Mitchell, an historian and political theorist at Columbia, and the author of Carbon Democracy, Political Power in the Age of Oil, from Verso. Watch out for part two of my interview, which I'll post this Friday. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said after noting that capitalist production simultaneously undermines the original sources of all wealth, the oil and the workers, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please do find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, please leave us a review. Those reviews help put us in touch with new listeners. What also does that is you telling your friends about the show. All propaganda on our behalf is greatly appreciated. And also, please do find us on patreon.com/thedig and make a contribution to keep this thing going. Even a few bucks a month is a big help.